You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 30th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Typesets, headlines, bylines, on broadsheet, Berliner or MIDI format, double spreads, below the fold or tabloid, on pink, yellow, white or buff stock. The Stack delves into the printing presses and finds out how to format the perfect newspaper. Bundle up for edition 66. A new wave of creativity or the last throes of a dying medium? This week, The Stack charts the latest developments in newspaper design with the help of two special guests with a lust for layouts. We'll also be going to Istanbul, where everything is still all Greek to some. We meet the people behind Turkey's second oldest newspaper.
It's not only the newspaper, it's the paper of the identity of a group who lives here. Without this newspaper, Istanbul is not the same Istanbul.
And from Turkey to Taiwan, where a new arts title hopes to bring something novel to the island nation's newsstands.
There's a really nice section. It's about the kitchen. I think the kitchen, everyone have experiences with kitchen. We are always interested in others' kitchen.
All that and plenty more besides on this 66th edition of The Stack right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brulé, where today we'll be guiding you through some of the best newspaper and magazine offerings via Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show, The Stack. Now, after a week on the road in the Nordic region and Japan, I'm wondering why more newspapers aren't spending time visiting the editorial floors in Oslo to see how things are done, and also the newsstands of the national convenience retailer Narvesen, to understand that selection and curation is what excites buyers of magazines and newspapers, and not limited choice. As for Japan, well, the future's silver. Here's a country that recognizes the monies with over 50s and not early 20-somethings. Here's hoping publishers in the Americas and Europe get the same memo. Now, as we've observed here on The Stack, newspaper relaunches, redesigns, and renames are an unrelenting part of the ever-changing landscape. The UK's Independent recently caused a veritable stir by literally dropping its banner to a brash vertical margin. In October, the venerable International Herald Tribune, boy do we miss it, was no more. And instead, we found the International New York Times in it on our doormat. To find out how one might go about revitalizing a tired format or how to draw in that paying, still print-hungry public, as well as to guide us through some of their favorite picks of magazines and periodicals, we have two very special guests around the table. Now, Patrick Burgoyne, one of the UK's most thoughtful and respected design commentators, has been the editor of Creative Review, wait for it, ladies and gentlemen, since 1999. Before joining the magazine as a staff writer, he worked in marketing, first for The Body Shop and later for the University of Westminster. He is the author of several books on design and visual culture and is also a revered critic in the field. And of course, creative and art directors, of course, beware when you send work his way. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, are you indeed the longest serving editor of a title of some international fame in this country? 1999, I mean, these days, that's a long gig.
It is a long gig. And yes, I suppose, yes, in my bleaker moments, I might think, well, it's because no one else wants to have me. But I suppose the thing that's kept me there is the way the landscape has changed and what we do has changed. So when I joined Creative Review, all we had to worry about was a monthly magazine. I
mean, you've even taken the magazine landscape.
Yeah, I suppose in a way, yeah. And I guess the way the job's changed is the way the publishing industry's changed. So now, of course, the website, we have an app, we do events, we do awards. So it's a very, very different role. But because it's in an area which, you know, I find very interesting and stimulating, I guess it's a nice kind of playground to be in that gives me lots of opportunities to get involved in different ways. So it's still exciting.
How much of a focus is there still on the printed page if you had to sort of divide up the editorial content month in and month out?
Well, print is still our primary source of revenue. It still makes far more money than...
But also, I should clarify that content-wise, when you're actually looking at creative work, you know, whether it's moving image or just, you know, good old photography ink on page.
It's a mix, really. I mean, I think there are certain stories, certain pieces of work which emerge during the course of the month that we know people will want to discuss, which have some kind of immediacy about them. So, for example, one of our main stories recently was the redesign of The Independent. So we knew that the day that hit the stands, we wanted to be out there with something to say about it. But that doesn't mean that we might not follow up later with something more reflective in the magazine. And I think the way we're dealing with the printed magazine, we're starting to try and be a way of framing the debates that have happened during the previous month, rather than just starting afresh with the printed magazine. So I think, you know, we're looking at a way of being able to do something, which I suppose is a little bit like a model like The Week has pursued, where you can look back at the month, but not just in terms of what you might have published, but what other people have been saying about that story, that piece of work, and sort of bringing in all the different debates around that, whether it's on social media, whether it's on other media outlets, whether it's been through some sort of event, and allowing people who've maybe not had the time to keep abreast of things as they're coming out to get up to date very, very quickly on not just the story, but the whole story around the story, if you see what I mean.
Mm. And in terms of, you know, creative focus and creative hubs, I can remember certainly when I came to this country, but even before that, growing up in Canada, you know, Creative Review was, you know, was there. It was something that sort of, you know, sat along so many other import titles at the time. It had this real sense of presence, and it, you know, represented the creativity that was coming out of the city as well. I'm wondering if you also feel that you're fighting against other centres now, that maybe once upon a time it was a bit of a New York versus London, and I'm wondering if there's a different sort of gravity that the magazine has internationally now.
Yes, I mean, I think certainly in terms of London's place in the creative world, that's being challenged. But then London itself has changed. So you walk into any large ad agency creative department in London now, and it's a League of Nations. You know, everybody needs their Swedes, their Brazilians, their, you know, and that's certainly the way. So the world has come to London in many respects in terms of the creative industry here. So, but yes, I we would definitely be certainly looking at now work that's coming out of Brazil or out of places in the Far East. So I think we're much more international in our coverage, in our readership too, of course. You know, being online, less than half of our readers online come from the UK. So, you know, we have that international perspective now.
Great. We're also joined around the table by John Belknap. He moved to the UK in 1992, and he's been the art director of Blueprint magazine, the Sunday Telegraph magazine, the Daily Express, the European, and the Sunday Business. He then ran a design studio specializing on redesigns and launches, and worked in the UK, Ireland, Switzerland, and even Brazil. And he's now the creative director of the British national weekly newspaper, The Jewish Chronicle. Welcome.
Hello.
Coming to this country in 1992 and just, you know, really picking up on what Patrick was saying, incredible sort of, you know, the focus that sat in this market, in print. So many American, you know, big publishers were looking at that time. It was almost this great exodus across the Atlantic as well for so many creatives and for so many editors. It was like that great sort of British invasion in the U.S. Mm. Why did you decide to come this way? Was it just the fact that you thought there was some empty chairs? What was it?
No, actually, it was because, my wife was one of those migrants over to the U.S., she's an art director as well, and she came over looking for work, and that's where I met her, actually. And then a few years later, she got a phone call inviting her to become art director of British Elle, and we thought, right, let's go to London then. And actually, when I got here, it was a recession. There were no jobs at all, and it was quite tough. But I've loved being here, and it's been great working with British editors, who I actually will admit I think are better than American editors at wordsmithing.
Let's maybe look at your CV pre 1992. What were you doing before you jumped on the plane in the U.S.?
Well, I had a long apprenticeship at the Village Voice newspaper. It's a leftist weekly. And then I worked at the New York Times, and then was launch art director of 7 Days, which was a great weekly as well, obviously weekly, edited by Adam Moss, who's now the editor of New York Magazine. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of where a lot of the sort of rock stars of New York media started. It was great fun.
It's interesting. You think back, 7 Days, it gained a lot of attention, and I can remember it from just, you know, purely a design perspective, shaking up not just the establishment of what was New York Magazine, but certainly where you'd been before with the Village Voice. For those who will recall it and were dipping in and out of New York at that time, what happened to it?
The publisher who owned it got bored, basically, and pulled the plug.
That happens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And but as a consequence, it did make its mark from a design point of view. And I guess let's because we want to focus largely on what happens above and below the fold today, in particular, sort of looking at newspapers in many ways. When you look back, what were you setting out to do in terms of a differentiation perspective, particularly in Manhattan or New York, where it is such a competitive and strong market for
sure.
weeklies, and every other week someone comes onto this program and we say why is there not the equivalent of New York Magazine in London, in Berlin, anywhere else in the world?
It is funny, isn't it? Well, there was always New York Magazine as a sort of a much earlier archetype of this kind of thing. But we had an odd proposition. Adam wanted to create something that was a cross between, as I remember, the New Yorker and the National Enquirer, which was, you wanted it to be literary and sophisticated, but he also wanted it to be quick, short, and slightly dirty. And it was quite a challenge. And I worked with a consulting art director named J.C. Suarez, who was a lovely guy who had an interesting idea. He said, let's make it look like German Expressionism from the 1920s. It was pulled it out of the hat, basically. So we commissioned a lot of illustration that was black and white with like severe lines and stuff like that. And it gave it a real look. And actually, you look back now, it's actually not, you look back now, you think, boy, it looks quite primitive. But, most magazines do now when you look back. But it was different. And I think sometimes distinctive is better than gorgeous sometimes.
Patrick, do you think we still look to New York for inspiration, not just jobs and maybe an extra zero at the end of your paycheck every month, from London, whether that's agencies or whether you're in an editorial environment, or has it died down? Do you think that people are maybe they're not going to get that extra zero in Berlin, but are they looking elsewhere? Because it seemed to be a little bit unilateral, at least when we're talking in terms of the 90s.
I think there's still an attraction in New York and the States generally because of the scale you can operate on. And I think people will always be seduced by that idea that suddenly you're reaching millions and millions of people through a publication, say, or if it's in the wider creative world through an advertising campaign or a piece of packaging or whatever. I think that size and scale is still, I think, quite seductive and quite a draw for people. And, recently we've seen people like Matt Willey go over and work in New York for a period. Chris Dixon, obviously, is there. Luke Heyman, people like that. So there's still that migration of talent, whether it's permanent or temporary. So I think there's still a draw there, definitely.
I think there's a drawback in that kind of big audience as well, though, because people are much more twitchy about making impulsive decisions, and because they know how much money they risk, and they are more likely to go to focus groups and things like that. Whereas here, editors go, I feel like doing this, and they do it, and it's just brilliant.
And if they can't do it here, then they go to Berlin. Or maybe they go to our next port of call, which is certainly attractive at the moment. We're heading to Istanbul, where it's easy to forget that newspapers can reflect the histories of places or countries. Nowhere is this more apparent than in Turkey. Since the founding of the Turkish Republic, the newspaper you read, whether it's the Milliyet or the Hürriyet, is a quick indicator of your political persuasions. It might be a surprise then to hear that Turkey's second oldest newspaper serves a community of 600 families in Greek. Our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana, sends us this report about a little-known newspaper that is single-handedly helping to keep Turkey's Greek community alive.
It was 1925 when the brothers Andos and Konstantinos Vasiadales opened the newspaper Apoivin Mantinin in Istanbul. At the time, the paper served Istanbul's 2 million-strong Greek community and sold more than 30,000 copies per day. Nearly 100 years later, there are just 600 Greek families living in Istanbul. Impossibly, the paper remains their community digest and is still published daily. For Mihal Vasiadales, the current editor and a relative of the founders, the paper is more than just a conduit of news.
There's one special thing about this newspaper. The special thing is that the story of the newspaper and the story of Istanbul's Greek society are parallel to each other. Istanbul's Greek society is gradually being dissolved, and if they disappear, the newspaper will disappear with them.
Apoivin Mantinin, which means afternoon in Greek, was able to survive with its circulation and revenue from 1925 until 1964. Then Greek society faced a crisis, partly stirred up by a series of pogroms in Turkey against minorities. In 18 months, between 1964 and 1965, the population decreased to one-third of what it used to be. Two out of three Greeks left Istanbul. Today, the paper's offices are still located in Beyoğlu's Syria Paja, an arcade that once housed the famous French daily, Stamboul. The office has been there for nearly 90 years, but rents are increasing and the future of the paper hangs in the balance. According to Dr. Dermitrios Triantafellou, the Greek director of the Center for International and European Studies at Istanbul's Kadir Has University, Istanbul's Greek community is almost as old as the city itself.
The Greeks of Istanbul, called Rum, have been here forever, were subjects of the Ottoman Empire, and have been subjects of Republican Turkey ever since Turkey has gained its independence. And they have had their good times and their bad times, where their population has slowly dwindled and a couple of times in the 50s and the 60s, and even in the 70s, certain pogroms were instigated against them. This is in the wider sort of chessboard of relations between Turkey and Greece and the rest of the international community. So there's a small community of Greeks here that are Turkish subjects, Turkish nationals, that have managed to maintain their heritage, their tradition, their language, but they're dwindling.
At moments during its long history, the paper received money from the Turkish government as an official minority paper. But the subsidies didn't last long. In 2002, Michal Vassiadelis returned to Istanbul from Greece to ensure that the paper continued. When he took over, the paper's circulation was down to 80 copies. Today, every Greek family in Istanbul is a subscriber, and some receive the paper in peculiar ways. Michal Vassiadelis, again.
Bu gazetenin önemli bir tarafı da dağıtımı.
One remarkable thing about this paper is its delivery process and how the readers receive it after the printing process. We have a few young delivery boys like me. One of them is 78. He takes the paper from the office, walks to Ferner, drops several ones along the way, and finishes his journey at Patriarchate. Our delivery man in Kadikoy has the key to one of the subscribers' apartment so that the newspaper will not get lost in case they're not at home. He knocks on the door. If no one's at home, he'll open the door, drop the paper and leave. We have dedicated readers like that.
In the current media climate, it is difficult to find an operation like Apoyven Matinin. With the proliferation of internet news and the speed of our news environment, media identity is increasingly schizophrenic. For Seljuk Tepili, the editor of the weekend edition of the Turkish daily Habertürk, Apoyven Matinin is an example of what a newspaper should be, an instrument of collective identity.
This is the very, very, very good example of that, this Greek newspaper, because it's not only the newspaper, it's the paper of the identity of a group who lives here. In Istanbul, a part of Istanbul. So without this newspaper, Istanbul is not the same Istanbul. And I don't like a lot this new Istanbul. That newspaper is part of the Istanbul's history. So it's a kind of, touristic monument or something. So you see, a newspaper is not only newspaper.
Towards the end of our interview, I asked Michal Vassiadelis about the future of his paper. He told me that concerned residents of Istanbul have donated money to keep the paper alive, and now his son is, quote, infected with the virus of journalism. He will keep the paper running and has plans to expand operations. Yet despite the seemingly dire task of keeping the newspaper, and by extension his community alive, Vassiadelis was optimistic.
Another remarkable point about the newspaper is that even though we have 600 copies, it can still enter the Guinness Book of Records. Because there are 600 families and we sell 600 copies. The newspaper with the highest circulation in Turkey is Zaman. For them to reach our percentage, they would need to sell 20 to 22 million copies. Of course, there's not really a bright future with only 600 copies, but it is a total saturation of the market.
İstikbal olmaz.
The tenacity and longevity of Apoyven Matinin reminds us of the tradition that only print media can carry through the ages. In the purest sense, the feeling of community that runs through the pages of Apoyvan Metianin belongs to another era and cannot be replicated in the current online media environment. From Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm joined by Patrick Burgoyne and also John Belknap. And, of course, Patrick is the editor of Creative Review. John is creative director at the Jewish Chronicle here in the UK. Listening to that, and, of course, I'm not sure what the demographic numbers look like exactly for the Jewish community in the UK, John, but did any of that sort of chime with you when you were listening to that that story?
Well, the readership certainly is in the UK very faithful to the JC, which is good for us. And we have a pretty high penetration as well, not 100% the way they do.
but when you look at, you know, also and certainly, you know, a shifting, you know, community and also the diaspora as well, there's something, quite a romantic story on one side, but not having to worry about all of the pressures of certainly digitally and otherwise, just focus on getting those 600 copies out and having the delivery man in his 70s who's got, you know, the key to the apartment.
It's fantastic, isn't it? It's very homey.
Indeed. Also listening to that as well, Patrick, I wanted to know, you know, when you sort of, you know, hear stories like this and just that purity of yeah, just getting, you know, just getting 600 copies out every day, do you kind of laugh at it? Or do you think that, you know, maybe it was ever thus and maybe this is the most modern newspaper in the world?
Well, yes, it's a very good argument, isn't it? I mean, there are certain things now where people have taken just one very small segment and done it brilliantly. And that's a very valid approach, I think, at the moment, because you just can't do everything.
No, exactly. We're going to be talking a lot more a little bit later as well. I want to pick up on what was the IHT, what we now call INIT, of course, the International New York Times. We'll be talking all kinds of things, certainly on news stock on this 66th edition of The Stack. Going away for a short break. We're back in a moment.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50. In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics, and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a shoelace factory in Hanover built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who've created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
Now, gentlemen, you have a series of magazines in front of you, but Patrick, you've got a book, and I'm wondering whether you want to start with the book first. And this is sure. One which has been doing the rounds throughout this building, not just because it's been published by Gestalten, who've also done our book, but just because it is just an extraordinary tome. But then I can see that you've got one Italian, certainly a supplement from one of our favorite Italian papers open as well. So where do you want to kick off the conversation?
Sure. Well, so the magazine that I have, the supplement, is Il, which obviously is from Il Sole 24 Ore, my best Italian accent, and a magazine which is notable for the fantastic infographics that it produces in this distinctive style with this kind of warm sepia background and these very, very strong black graphics. And we've just got a spread open here from quite an old issue, which is looking at the arms industry, and it's absolutely fantastically produced. So the guy behind a lot of that work, Francesco Franchi, he's written this book, Designing News, which is not just about the impact of infographics and data visualization and the way it enables us to tell different stories in different ways, but is actually more ambitious than that, because it's looking at the whole process of how news is produced, how newspapers are produced, and proposing some ideas for the future of that. So I think it's not only a beautiful looking book and a beautifully produced book, but it's got some fascinating content in it too, I think.
Do you think it's about time that Mr. Franchi is getting, let's say, greater international recognition, maybe outside of just art directors' clubs, etc.? Because you know, he's done such a brilliant job over the years with infographics. And I think, you know, certainly a lot of people have really been looking to Il Magazine. But then along comes Bloomberg Business Week. And of course, very good work done there. But, you know, I've heard some people argue that there might have been sort of the odd thing also, you know, lifted or certainly influenced by this. Sure, you know. And maybe that, you know, that Il just hasn't received the international attention that the likes of a Bloomberg Business Week has.
Yes. And, I guess the fact that Bloomberg Business Week, it's from the States. It's got this massive brand behind it. It has had a lot of exposure and a lot of talk about it. And by its nature, I suppose Il has not quite benefited to the same extent. But I think... you know, those in the know have long been looking at what Il does and I think been very influential. But I think that world of infographics and data viz is maturing rapidly, and it's becoming actually about more than just the newspaper and the magazine world. I mean, I was a judge recently on the Information is Beautiful Awards, and talking to the people who run their studio, a lot of their work now is coming from corporate clients who are using those techniques to understand their organizations and to tell their stories, both inwardly to their own staff and outwardly in marketing exercises. So it's very interesting how those techniques are now becoming more and more useful to people.
I mean, many would argue as well that actually Bloomberg was already doing that. I remember being in his bullpen at City Hall in New York, and he'd brought the people in from the Bloomberg organization. This predates the relaunch of Business Week. And, you know, and there you could see in real time how many calls were coming into their 311 number just complaining about snow removal and how many people were engaged in using sort of different languages on those phone trees and whatever it is. But it's amazing when you go to a lot of companies right now, it's like, you know, how many people are sort of delayed on transport and all of these types of things which are flashing up. But when you mentioned that point, is that what you meant by maturity, though, that it's that infographics, it's reaching a point that it's touching so many sectors in society, or also that, do you also mean a little bit of overuse across a spread or a page as well?
I don't mean overuse. I think what I'm hoping is it's going beyond pretty pictures and actually really telling us something interesting in a way that we couldn't have gleaned from another technique. And you know, when I think back over the years of many of the examples which are held up of being really interesting uses of early kind of infographics, they were style over substance. You know, they were seductive and they looked beautiful, but did they actually tell me something that I couldn't have got just from reading a 1,000-word piece? Probably not. But I think now, particularly with interactive data visualization techniques and things like, for example, going back to Bloomberg, they've got this fabulous Bloomberg Billionaires site, which you can slice and dice all sorts of data on the world's richest people. It's got a great interface. It's very entertaining, but it's also very illuminating and interesting. And I think we are starting to see now that those promises are being delivered on, that they can tell stories, they can reveal relationships, they can introduce some fascinating context into information. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in my world about big data and its influence on marketing and organizations generally, that we now have the ability to collect enormous amounts of data, but we've got to try and understand this stuff somehow. And I think a lot of the techniques which have been developed for data visualization are very helpful in that way.
John, when you look at, you know, when you came over from New York in the 90s, was there a sense that, maybe the British papers had good editors, but did you feel that they were also ahead from an art direction point of view? Did you feel there was more freedom? And now I think when you, let's say, compare and contrast, you know, whether it's WSJ magazine and what the New York Times is doing, et cetera, versus what you see in the UK or on the continent, who is leading the way, or what are points of inspiration for you?
There was a different style, basically, between American design and British design, especially when I got here. The British design was more direct. Headline, text, boom, bash, boosh. It was, you know, it was quite almost brutal, but I quite like that because I like designing like that. Whereas in America, it was much more sort of florid and flourishy and lots of decoration, but not necessarily a lot of content in that decoration. We just made it look pretty, which took a lot of time. And to me, I just thought, let's get on with it. Let's do it, you know, more brutalistically, if you will, if that's a word. Now, looking for inspiration, gosh, I love all the sort of Jeremy Leslie styles, you know, young startups and things like that. In the newspapers, it's all gone a bit funny. I mean, I brought in this copy of the International New York Times, which used to be the Herald Tribune, because I bought it and I was stunned at how boring it was. It's just sort of long columns of type with very still-looking pictures. And I thought, this is not modernism the way it should, modernism should be. This is
and
just
you've got the Berlusconi cover from the other day, and yeah. it's also was that really the best picture
of all people yeah. looking very sort of calm and kind of well yeah. you know squinty. I mean, if you compare it with Bild, which is this sort of wonderfully hideous German paper that is just. It looks like somebody shot the type of the page with a scatter gun or something. I love how
well, I was
going to
say, maybe Hurriyet could give it a run for its money.
Hurriyet would definitely be a candidate. They read that a lot in my neighborhood in North London. But I love how alive it is. And I think the ideal newspaper is a cross between the two. You know, I think the Times, actually, if you look through the Times, it's beautifully formal. And yet they liven it up with lots of pictures and lots of little stories. And as you get into the supplements and things, it gets more and more magaziney and delightful to look at. So I think they do a really good job of combining the two. I think you can go too far either way.
Are you perhaps not dismayed, but just surprised by the lack of excitement? I mean, we see a lot of redesigns, and we can talk about it a little bit more, but just, you know, general sort of, you know, first impressions when you're not just looking at the likes of, you know, the lovely sort of, you know, pink, you know, pages of Il Sole, or just sort of, you know, the broad spectrum of the newsstand. Are you missing a bit of excitement?
Yes.
Yes, definitely. I think, yes. I mean, and strangely, because so many newspapers are at a sort of crisis point and yet still don't seem to have the courage to take that final leap and rip up the rule book. I mean, I think the Independent's recent redesign was beautiful and fantastic styling. The typefaces are great. There's great attention to detail. But a lot of what they were talking about was trying to get back to some of the qualities the newspaper had when it launched. And interesting, when we had the debate about this online, you know, somebody was saying, well, why didn't they just go the whole hog and just become a news magazine instead of a newspaper? And I could see that, you know, making some sense. But who knows the economics behind the world of daily newspapers these days? I mean, it's a difficult, murky place, I guess.
Yeah, but it's and then you sort of look at some free sheets, which are able to probably, you know, turn around their titles, and at the same time, the likes of, you know, of Shortlist, Stylist in this market, which are free, and they seem to dominate the boarding ramps of any British Airways flight anyway, as much as the Daily Mail does. That maybe there is a possibility. Economics aside, do you see anything else internationally, though, and sort of moving beyond the British newsstand that you featured recently? You think, okay, there's a kernel in this. You know, here are some editors or some art directors who are onto something interesting. Anything that's crossed your bow lately?
I'm struggling to think that there's something that I really felt had moved the needle to any great extent. I think there have been a couple of interesting approaches to responding to a particular lifestyle. So, for example, I brought in this Hole and Corner magazine. This is its second issue, and this is a magazine which its cover line says it's celebrating craft, beauty, passion and skill. So it's basically, it's tapping into this fetishization of craft. You know, this is the Shoreditch trendy walking around in its hand-stitched brogues and his, you know, going and buying one of those American-made axes that cost hundreds of dollars just to put up on his wall. He's never going to chop any wood with it. But I think that there's something very, very beautiful about the lifestyle it evokes, and it's done with great care and love. And I think it's a very interesting sort of timely magazine about a particular thing that's happening right now. And, you know, I remember the first issue had a lovely piece about the man who makes Gray Nichols cricket bats and just the celebration of that skill and knowledge and craft, I think, was wonderful. And I think, you know, looking at the new issue, there's some very, very beautiful and inspiring stories in there, some of which obviously cross over into the kind of creative world. There's a piece about the head of art at BBH's ukulele collection.
Right.
That's one for the specialist. But there's a piece about, you know, these beautifully made surfboards, and even the type itself that they're using is one of Mr. Smith's wood types, I think. You know, it's a very, very beautiful thing for, you know, okay, a small audience, but a dedicated audience, I guess.
John, is that what really great magazines do? I mean, they define a moment in time. If you look back at the era of Sky and Blitz and The Face, and this, you know, they were very much representative of what was happening in music and fashion, but also typographically, etc. And they're all, none of them are with us any longer. And I'm wondering, you know, when you look at something like this as well, that Home Corner will be the same thing. It may not be around forever, but it does represent this build your own chicken coop and invest in expensive, you know, cutlery from the Nordic world, etc.
Sure. I mean, magazines always reflect the sort of, you know, trends of the times and the passions of the Blitz and The Face and all that. That's long gone. But I think in a funny way, I quite like the traditional glossies like Vanity Fair and GQ and all that, because in this drab, austere world, you know, it's nice to be in this wonderfully constructed fantasy that you get to sort of live in for a while and just think, oh, yeah, I'd love to drive that car or go out with that model or whatever it is. And it's a wonderful sort of fantasy. And people work real hard to make that fantasy sustain through however many pages there are. And I love being transported like that, even though I can't afford a single thing that they, you know, that they write about or whatever it is. It's just lovely to be there. And so I don't miss, you know, the sort of, you know, the punky face or whatever, because I think right now we need the sort of the glossies.
Mm.
And maybe later on, you know, we'll have another wave of, you know, of punky kind of things or whatever comes up. But that's what's going on now.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're taking a very short break, but we're back right after this.
This Christmas, gather up your elves, load up the sleigh, and head to Midori House for our annual Christmas fair. We'll be hosting our favourite nations and retailers, mixing up Swiss Weihnachten and Japanese Kurisumasu with traditional Yuletide cheer. You can stock up on Christmas presents for your loved ones, pet our reindeer, enjoy performances from our musical guests. You can even meet our Finnish VIP, Santa Claus. It's all happening at Midori House at 1 Dorset Street from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. on the 7th and 8th of December.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And this is The Stack on Monocle 24. My guest today, Patrick Burgoyne, editor of Creative Review, and John Belknap, creative director at the Jewish Chronicle here in London. Gentlemen, why don't we look at some of the titles you've got? John, before we went to the break, you were talking about just that love of just the good old magazine, you know, glossy, balshy, non-apologetic, a bit of a machine. And I see you've wired there, and, yeah. And definitely, you know, a title which... you know, in many ways, it was a champion of the avant-garde and represented this extraordinary digital boom. No one knew where it was going to go. Is, you know, how strange it was edited out of San Francisco, and you know, who would have thought that such a title could have global influence, et cetera, et cetera. It gets picked up by Condé Nast, and it's still here today and is very much part of the establishment. Why do you want to talk about it?
Yes, as you say, before, when Wired first started, it was all about stuff that you really didn't know what they were talking about, and you had to read it really carefully, thinking, what?
I remember there was a piece about there was this solar toaster, yeah. And everything that we were going to eat was going to sort of, you know, somehow be solar baked, and I thought, wow, this is amazing, you know, never to be seen again.
Well, I don't know. There's a piece in this one about the smart house, you know, and how you can, you know, get the house to sort of, you know, water your plants for you and stuff like that.
But have we even hearing about that since Popular Mechanics days?
I suppose this is maybe it's more real now.
Right.
Maybe it's going to happen. Well, I mean, considering how hard it is to set up your own, you know, digital infrastructure at home, I kind of doubt it. But it's just, again, it's a fantasy world of glossy machines and bright colors. And I'm distracted by anything. I just love this kind of. These worlds, everyone's a little planet you can go on, you know, and enjoy, and also maybe learn something about high tech, which is always, you know, going to have new things to learn about.
Now, there's a British edition, of course, there's the original U.S. edition. What are you partial to? Because I sort of, you know, I feel if I'm going to pick one up and I see both of them on the newsstand, I want to go for the American one because I think they're getting it from the source. And I think, this is a world where everything sort of, you know, moves in real time. Even though I'm consuming this on paper, I think it's just... The British edition is just, you know, it's still a trip across the sea. What about you?
Well, I have an inside track because my original editor at the JC was David Rowan, who's now the editor of Wired. And I know that he is really plugged in and very, very smart. And I will follow him anytime.
Okay. All right. Well, politics aside, Pat, what about you?
What, in terms of Wired?
Yeah. Or just, you know, in terms of... in terms of international editions in general, whether there's going to be even a, if Il Sole decided to offer up some of their supplements to British newspapers, would you still want to go to the source? You know, maybe your command of Italian aside.
Go to the source. That's my thing. I mean, I just feel like the American edition of Wired, it's Silicon Valley versus Silicon Roundabout, and to me, Silicon Valley sounds far more seductive, and I feel like that's where it's happening first. And if I want to know, I'm going to go straight there.
When you look at the marketplace right now, and when, and I'm not saying, of course, clearly not everyone reads or speaks English, but you just look at that the power that English language has. Do you think we see more publishers moving away from regional editions, and that we might, or at least devolving power to regional editions, and maybe saying, look, we're actually just going to actually construct all of Wired in San Francisco, and we're just going to print it in the UK. We'll insert the ads, but in fact, there's not going to be a London editor. Do you think we move down that track with Elle magazine or Harper's Bazaar when there's still going to be cost, there's still going to be a cost crunch probably, and of course you can find out about the local celebrity. You can introduce that person, but maybe everything will be done, from Hearst's headquarters for all of their titles, and they just translate them.
Potentially, I suppose, but you wonder whether the technology we have now allows for more customization and sort of local versions, local language versions. Surely there's some potential there in future of being able to customize the experience for a local audience.
Just when I look at a title like the JC, the Jewish Chronicle in London, how important for you, John, is the physical edition, and of course you look at sort of from a multi-generational perspective, very established Jewish families in North London where this is a defining probably feature around the breakfast table, versus what is the pressure being then to of course be much more actively engaged in a digital perspective.
Well, we have a unique position because if you're Jewish and you're religious, you don't use any electricity past Friday night until Saturday night. One thing you can do is read the paper. So we have an automatic lock-in with a lot of people, which is terrific for a print product. So we do concentrate very, very intensely on that. And we're, like any media company, we've been through sort of ups and downs, and we're now redoing our website and getting more active. It already gets quite a lot of attention, but it doesn't look that fabulous yet, but mark my words, it will.
And is there a loose network internationally as well where you might be, connected then to, if there is an equivalent then in Johannesburg and in Sao Paulo and in Paris at the same time? Or do you, are you not really operating on, you are on an island, but are you a little bit in isolation, or is there a bit of a network in terms of sharing things internationally amongst the Jewish community?
That's an interesting idea. I think our concentration is Britain and international, but in our case, international is mostly Israel. Not so much attention to the States, oddly. And I think there's room for thinking that through more. But at the moment, that's what we're doing. But I think if you were a British expat in Israel, you'd be quite interested in looking at that.
I want to go to another story in a moment, but Patrick, you've got a copy of Libération there. They did something brilliant a couple of weeks. I'm not sure if that's the issue that you have, but then they did you brought in the day without photos.
I did.
Tell us why you bought it.
I just thought it was a fantastic, bold idea. So it was tying in with the Paris Photo event, and in order to sort of celebrate the importance of the image and bring home the power of the image and the role it plays in informing us and telling us about the news, they published on the 14th of November an issue without photography, except for the ads, although there's relatively few ads in Libération, so it still works and they can still make their point. And then what they did at the end, which is rather nice, is a spread with thumbnails of the photographs that they would have used had it been a regular edition of the newspaper. So, and I think, it was talked about all over the place. It made quite a splash when it came out. So I think it was just a really interesting idea.
Yeah, and then who would have known that weeks later they would have also had an attack on the paper as well, which was unfortunate and extraordinary at the same time. I often wonder, and I'm not sure what you think when you look at it, and you said there's not very many ads. There's never very many ads in Libération, and yet it's there. And so I was thinking, are they, that that small banner across the bottom. Are they charging, you know, 50,000 euros for it? I'm not sure, but it is. It's always amazing how it sustains itself. I thought we would head over to Taiwan at the moment, where there's been a positive explosion of new magazine titles. However, you could say few managed to jump out from the newsstand as quality publishing. That seems to be particularly true when it comes to visual arts titles. But one new magazine is intent on setting a new course. Not Today seeks some inspiration from European fashion food titles, but also wants to maintain a very Taiwanese feeling. Our reporter, Chris Fitch, met the magazine's editors, Xiaoba Chan and Ichio Chan.
People were like, did you import this magazine from somewhere? We say, no, it is a Taiwanese magazine. And then people say, wow, it's nice.
On the third floor of a building tucked away down a side street in South Taipei is the home of publishing company Waterfall, who last week launched their new art magazine, Not Today. Editors Xiaoba Chang and Ichio Chen invited me into their office, where they sat surrounded by scattered papers, stacks of magazines, and...
have cats. One is Didi and another one's Coco. Not Today is a magazine that we want to do as an art magazine, but not like a usual magazine with reviews of the exhibition or the artists. We want to do it more like a lifestyle magazine with the concept space and to explore the possibilities of art and the life and the relation between people and life. We both were students and I was doing freelancing for some art magazines in Taiwan. And we always just talk about magazines. And since we love independent publishing, I asked Xiaoba if I could do an interview with her and Waterfall magazine, which was the previous publication she did. Now we just started to work together. And Not Today, you could say this is the first magazine we wanted to do together.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about the inspiration for Not Today.
Yeah, there's some magazines, our favorites, such as A La Carta, Italian magazine about food and fashion, and also like Planet Journal, which is also a very good magazine with plants. And I think what they've done have shown us different attitude and different way to do a magazine. So I think that's how we start working on our own magazine.
Maybe you could take me through the magazine a little bit, show me some of the different chapters.
When you first look at the pages, you might think it's about interior design or product design, but actually it's not. We said the main concept is space, and we wanted to talk about the relationship between people and space, and maybe about art. For example, there's a really nice section is about the kitchen. I think the kitchen, everyone have experiences with kitchen. We are always interested in others' kitchen, their space, what people can do in that space.
Obviously, you're doing this magazine in Taiwan and there's a lot of international coverage in the magazine. You've got these international artists, you've got articles in London and all parts of the world. And so High Taiwan seems quite important to kind of root the magazine in Taiwan. It is a Taiwanese magazine.
We always say there are many interesting places in Taiwan, and maybe we know this is nice and we want to introduce to our foreign friends, but we don't just want to say this is nice, you can go, and we want people to see places or things differently. So maybe it could be a way to show whatever Taiwanese or foreign people the way to see Taiwan.
How would you describe the magazine industry in Taiwan? How different is this to what else is out there?
We have a lot of titles in Taiwan. Every few months you will see a new magazine pop out, but we are quite a small publishing company. I think we are one of the very few publishing companies in Taiwan doing only contemporary visual arts.
So do you think you're quite unique? Maybe you kind of stand out?
as far as I know, I think we are the only one publishing company doing magazines and photo books at the same time.
Who are your target audience?
We didn't set the target audience, but I think people with passion for life and maybe they love art and design, they will like this magazine.
Where do you go from here? How many editions are you going to have?
At the moment, we want to publish only 6
as a project first, and then we see how it goes, and then we decide how we're going to develop it to, like, we can do something more or we can do other things.
What if it's really popular and you've done your 6? Are you allowed to just make more?
Of course, I hope so. And also, I think if it's really popular, we're willing to do more, maybe bi-monthly or something like that.
And that was our Chris Fitch in Taipei, speaking to the editors of the new magazine, Not Today, Shoba Chan and Ichio Chan. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. It's almost time to go, which means I'm probably going to give you one more magazine, Patrick, to choose from. I can see you put NME there.
I did. I brought it along because it's had a redesign, another redesign. It's been struggling, obviously. There's so many more sources that people can go to now to find out about the world. It's not,
and used to be a tabloid in its day.
Yes, exactly. And it used to be that fantastic thing where people like me, growing up in pretty dull small towns in the middle of nowhere, could feel like we were somehow connected with this exciting world of music out there. And it was a lifeline for many big people. And now, of course,
and was it a race to the newsstand for you? And you,
yeah, absolutely.
What day was publication day?
Oh God, I think it was Thursday. Wasn't
right,
it? I think it was a Thursday.
Yeah,
is that right? I can't remember. Anyway, but now, of course, the internet, Facebook, there are many, many other things that you can do that. So, I mean, I really like the redesign. I think it's got lots of oomph to it. I like its energy. I like its strength. But, I mean, John was talking earlier about the amount of free magazines there are around now. And somehow a lot of the qualities that NME has now are shared by things like Shortlist and Stylist and so on. So whether it can carve out that space where people feel like they should actually be paying for this stuff, that's going to be very, very difficult for them, I think. But it's purely from an aesthetic point of view, and I like its energy.
Mm. I mean, John, you've already made it very clear that you like a magazine with a red title strap. I mean, you know, being a fan of Build and Hurry It, what do you make of the redesign?
Well, I think it's fine. I think it needs to be.
It's fine.
I think it needs more energy. I think this is a good place to start. And I think when you first put in a redesign, you've done the formula, and then you think, now how can we make this really live? And I think I can tell they will, just looking at that, because you've got an exciting topic, don't you?
Yeah,
it's perfect.
Arctic Monkeys sell. I'm going to give you one more title as well.
My favorite magazine in this country is The Guardian Weekend, and it's beautifully designed, and it has a very predictable setup of great columnists, recipes, fashion, where to move if you wanted to. And I just love every single bit of it. I love all the personalities. It's like it's a part of my week I cannot do without. And it's like a little community that I get involved with once a week. And I just adore it.
And you talk about sort of the columnists and the lineup. Is it the familiarity and also sort of the coziness, because, you know, you're not from here. Does it root you in the UK as well? And is it a sense of place element for you as opposed to taking you somewhere else?
Well, it's like having a bunch of very erudite friends telling you stories. You know, it's quite nice. And I've been here for 20 years, so I can't complain about feeling rootless. But but I just happen to like all those people, and I'm always interested to see what they say and write about and take pictures of. It's great.
Excellent. Well, that brings us to the end of this 66th edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Blay. Special thanks to my guests today, Patrick Burgoyne and John Belknap. Our producer was David Pleasant, and behind the glass here at Midori House has been our studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. Of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, for me, goodbye.